It is Thursday, December 29th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Emma!
Yeah. Yes, I interviewed Dan Cannon, civil rights lawyer and professor at the University of Louisville, author of the book Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. This is one of my favorite interviews of the year, and I'm glad people submitted it for Best Of. Just the sheer number of people who are funneled into a plea bargaining system where they might have better chances not taking a plea, but that there's an entire incentive structure that, despite their guilt or innocence, pressures people into that system, and really why lawyers, why judges, why they like it, and why it's really not in your benefit. Really one of my favorite discussions of the year, so I'm glad this made it.
Excellent. And, of course, Thursdays, known throughout the Majority Report universe, is the day that the show becomes the Majority Report.
Emma Thurs.
Emma.
That too.
Majority Report, which, of course, that reminds me, you can get merch.
No, it was limited sale, so you cannot get the Majority Report, if you recall.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, it was limited.
Is that true?
Limited edition, yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I mean, that was what was offered to me, and I said, go ahead.
That doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't we make that a limited edition?
I don't know.
All right.
I mean, I'm going to go on the website now and see.
Are you sure? That doesn't make any sense. Why would we do that?
I think
the pause, the like, I'm losing it, bro. That makes sense to me why that would be limited edition, or ask the moms, which we never actually did.
God.
But I don't understand why
it's not there anymore. It was
seriously
limited edition. I told you, yes.
It's dumb. We already paid for the whole like graphic design of
this
it.
This is not my. This is not. Don't yell at me.
Oh, God.
Yell at you.
God. Well, you know, one of the it's apropos because in a couple of days we all make New Year's resolutions, and mine's going to be no more limited editions for Emma Majority Report merch.
Perfect.
So we're gonna ramp that thing back up. That's that's my resolution.
There you go.
And so I'm making it something I can keep.
That's
it's
good.
Just the tough part's going to be remembering. So somebody remind me. Meanwhile, also today, it's not just going to be the interview you did about plea bargains creating a criminal underclass with Dan Cannon, but also we have for today something from David Feldman, that time where he called in from London and reported on the death of the Queen.
The Royal Correspondent.
Mm. Yeah, that's one of the major happenings in 2022.
The Windsor Bosom.
The Windsor Bosom. And I was going to say, if you'll recall the Windsor Bosom.
And he called in, reported, really, on that. And then what
our
we did is...
Our international correspondent.
Yes, and we made him a lord. By
good.
The I printed up a document and I said, you are now a lard, as we call them. And he became a British aristocracy.
Good.
And so he's
been
got
acting
that.
Like it ever since.
He's
yeah.
been really larding himself around us.
Yeah, coincidentally, we just looked through Jeffrey Epstein's black book and David Feldman on it now.
There,
not really.
probably. All right. Everything you've heard is satire today, and et cetera, et cetera. Take no. Maybe he's a,
I think David would appreciate that.
Dave would appreciate that, yeah. But you know, one never knows. You get a little cantankerous as you get older. Maybe you start to smell an opportunity for litigation, and
let's not
press anything. Folks, enjoy today's program. We will be back tomorrow. Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. And we'll be back tomorrow. We've got two more. Really, tomorrow is the last Best Of 2022, and the last show in 2022, because time keeps on slipping into the future, as they say.
Yeah.
So, and then on Monday, we have one more Best Of. Here we go. Enjoy today's show. See you tomorrow.
We are back, and we are joined now by Dan Cannon, civil rights lawyer, law professor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, and author of Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. Dan, thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So let's give everybody a quick rundown of plea deals, if you don't mind, especially for listeners outside of the U.S. who might not be fully familiar with this practice, which is amazingly ubiquitous. How do they work, and how widespread are they here?
Well, it's amazingly ubiquitous in the United States, right? We resolve about 97% of all criminal cases with a plea bargain, with a guilty plea that is usually a result of a bargained agreement between a defense lawyer and a prosecutor, right? And so sometimes they are wheeling and dealing about what charges a defendant ought to face. And sometimes we call that charge bargaining, and sometimes it's wheeling and dealing over what sort of penalties a defendant might face, which we call sentence bargaining. And it's important to understand that no place else in the world does it the way that we do, because we've given prosecutors so much leeway to use any sort of bargaining tactics, any carrot, any stick. And that's a lot of what's resulted in this high number of plea bargain cases. The rest of the world tops out at maybe 80% at the highest, but we're much higher than that.
So a lot of this is due to immense prosecutorial discretion, and I think you could argue, I believe you do very effectively, scales tilted very much in favor of the prosecution, particularly when the defendant is poorer, and that's when they're more likely to take some of these plea deals. What are some of the power dynamics at play now that we're at this astronomical figure of 97% of guilty pleas coming through this process?
Sure. Well, what you're looking at here is a system that has essentially been built for speed and nothing else, right? You know, when people conceptualize what our criminal justice system is about, right? I should call it a criminal legal system because there's really nothing just about it. We think of, you know, what we see on television. You think about trials and procedurals and these intense fact-finding missions and a search for the truth. When in reality, it's become a bureaucratic process, right? And what we've developed over the last 200 years is a system that operates on the principle of speed above all else. We are trying to convict as many people as quickly as we possibly can and sweep them into this massive criminal class. When you look at the outcomes, criminal justice outcomes in the United States versus the whole rest of the world, you know, we do plea bargaining way more than anybody else. We also convict more people. We lock more people up. Our arrest rates are much higher than other countries that have similar legal systems. And you have to wonder why. Well, in the book, what I lay out is the plea bargaining is the why. That is the mechanism that has allowed so many people to get swept into this enormous criminal class since we started the practice in the 1830s.
So let's go to the 1830s there, because that was so fascinating to me to do a dive into the origins of plea deals and how they came to be. I did not realize that it started in the 1830s, so in New England. Take us through that time period and how this began.
It's very brave of you to ask a law professor to go all the way back to the 19th century and say, just go. I assume we have limited time on this segment, so I'll try to make it.
Honestly, we don't. And so this part was really honestly the most fascinating element to me. So I'd love if you could expand on this as much as you see fit.
Yeah. So I think what's really important for your viewers to understand is that plea bargaining was initiated as a tactic to undermine the labor movement. Right. We don't think about it that way. We don't see it play out that way now. But that's what it was. So if you go back to the 1830s in New England, which is when scholars think plea bargaining really started in America, at that time, you've got this enormous rise in the working class and rise in power of the working class, right? The first Federation of Labor Unions was formed in New York in 1834. And you've got universal white male suffrage. So you have, you know, working class, unlanded white men for the first time sitting on juries all over the country. And juries were enormously powerful. So what the courts were trying to do at that time, what the ruling classes were trying to do was prosecute people, workers who were organizing. So they were trying to prosecute them as groups. And when they became too big to continue doing that, the courts had to find new strategies for sweeping lots of people into the criminal class, right? For what they started to do was criminalize the behaviors of individual workers. So you see all these prosecutions under these gigantic and vague statutes like drunken disorderly or vagrancy or whatever. You see these individual prosecutions start to happen in lieu of prosecuting groups of workers. And what happens along with that, as a result of doing that and by instituting plea bargaining, you're able to sweep the same number of workers into a big criminal class so they're alienated from their communities and everybody else, and you take juries out of the equation, right? So the juries were becoming more and more sympathetic to working class people. And so there's like, well, okay, let's not have any more jury trials. Let's come up with a quick and easy way to get all these convictions. And we'll make it seem like the working class people that are getting charged with these things have a stake in the matter, that they can just strike a deal with the state, right? And over time, that grew into being the main method, really the only method at this point for resolving criminal cases. If you look at, you know, our numbers essentially indicate that the jury trial, for all intents and purposes, is dead and has been dead since the early 19th century, way before women could ever sit on juries, way before people of color could ever sit on juries, right? The idea of a jury of one's peers has never really happened in the criminal context in the United States.
That is, yeah, I think that breaks the brains of a lot of people, given the mythology about our criminal justice system in the United States. Like, I mean, I was just talking about Law and Order is being filmed in Brooklyn. I just walked by it today, going to work. And that's the entirety of our cultural perception about trials and the fairness of it, jury of your peers. And in 2022, they've largely been cut out of the equation.
They don't happen. And because they happen so infrequently, think about the kind of juries that we do see now, right? You know, back in the 1830s, you're just starting to see working class juries, right? And before that, it was just a certain kind of person that got on a jury. And we like to think that we've evolved since then. But look at who sits on juries now. If you look at the statistics on who sits on a jury, it's mostly upper middle class white people who can afford to be there for, you know, X amount of days, right? And we have so few jury trials that we can be very selective about who ends up on a jury, and we are, right? You know, so there's a study out of Houston that says only 20% of the people who are called to jury duty in the first place even show up. Because those are the people who can afford it, or who have, you know, who are interested enough to show up, or who don't think it's just a drag and a waste of time, right? And those folks tend to be upper middle class white people. So they're the ones that end up on the juries time and time and time again. Again, you end up with these juries that look nothing like a cross section of the community, and certainly nothing like most of the people that are getting charged with crimes.
And so let's go back a little bit to the labor movement discussion and how. So in the 1830s, if I'm not mistaken, that the population in New England was starting to really explode pretty quickly because of the Industrial Revolution, which that's really when the United States labor movement does begin to develop. The juries then, with that new explosion of population, was it partly because the juries were beginning to be filled with working class people who were setting precedent that was beneficial to other working class people, and that was an attempt to claw that back?
Yes, 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 indeed. So you see two things happen in the 19th century, right, in New England specifically. at that time, juries were enormously powerful. So we think about, you know, juries are very powerful now. It's the most power you can have for most of us as citizens. But back then they were even more powerful because they decided issues of fact and issues of law, right? Today we think of the jury as the fact finder. When you talk to lawyers about what a jury does, the jury is a finder of fact. And the judge decides what the law is. The judge gives the instruction to the jury about the law, and then the jury finds a fact. So, you know, if the case is about whether or not somebody ran a red light, the jury determines the ultimate fact of whether or not that person ran the red light. Well, in the 19th century, they decided issues of law. So this is a terrible example to use for the 19th century, but roll with it. If they would have said that whether or not it was illegal to run the red light, right, you know, in the first place, so they can determine issues of law. And it's very dangerous to give that kind, if you're the ruling classes, it's very dangerous to give that kind of power to regular working class guys who don't have land and who, you know, have unwashed, calloused hands and this whole thing. So they start to, the first thing that happens is they take that power, the power to determine issues of law, away from juries. And you see in the literature at the time, like, juries are stupid. They're too dumb to do this stuff. Let's take this. Let's leave this power to the judges, and so all of that power to decide issues of law is consolidated in judges. And at the same time, they're working on ways to just take all criminal cases, period, but all criminal cases away from juries. And what I argue is that the plea bargain was the primary mechanism that they used to do that. Plea bargains are quick. They're easy. You go in for, you know, 2 minutes and you do a little bit of back and forth, and the state has a gun to your head, so you're going to take whatever offer they have on the table, and everybody's done. It's, you don't have to go through the mess or the expense or the time or the embarrassment in some cases of a trial. So that's been very appealing to both sides over the years. But what I argue is that the net effect is that all this plea bargaining has removed the public from the processes of criminal justice altogether. And that's done a lot of harm to our democracy.
So essentially, juries were deciding what the law would be in that time period. And that was a level of direct democracy it's not even democracy, but maybe it is. I shouldn't even couch it. A level of direct democracy that made the powers that be a bit uncomfortable, which is fascinating. And it they took that right away in the 1850s. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So if you look at what was going on in Massachusetts, this was a big debate at the time. I actually didn't know this until I started researching for the book, because we've taken it for granted. You know, American lawyers take it for granted. Juries are the finders of fact, and that's just what they do. Judges always instruct on the law. But it just wasn't that way in the early 19th century. And this was a big debate at the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention. There was a lot of this. Well, if you're just, you know, you're taking power away from the people. Some legislators argued this. You're taking power away from the people and giving it to judges. And that's undemocratic, and we shouldn't do that. But that's what happened. The legislatures ultimately took that power away from juries and gave it to judges. And at the same time, you have all this stripping away of the number of trials that are happening in the first place. And that happened at an enormous rate. So if you think about the 1830s, you know, plea bargaining was taboo. Before 1830, it was illegal. It was unheard of to do that kind of thing. And prosecutors would get prosecuted for trying to make deals with defendants. So 0% plea bargaining rate in 1830. By 1850, that's jumped to 50% of the criminal cases decided in Massachusetts. And by the 1880s, you're up to 88% of all criminal cases decided in Massachusetts, subject to a plea bargain. And, you know, to go back to what I said earlier, you're looking at 1880, you know, there's essentially no more criminal trials in Massachusetts, and women are not allowed to serve on a jury until 1950 in Massachusetts. So the idea that we've ever had a jury of one's peers in this country is ridiculous, because the practice spread like wildfire, especially during Prohibition, when everybody was, you know, just crazy for getting criminal convictions to go as fast as possible, because there was just so much new crime made all of a sudden as a result of the 18th Amendment. And what you've seen over time is just the almost the total death of the jury trial and the removal of the community from criminal justice.
Was it always the case that the prosecution was essentially allowed to handpick jurors based on what they thought would be best for their case?
Well, so there's always a been a voir dire process, right? So that's something that, that we got from English common law and that's been around for a long time. So, you know, the lawyers get to pick jurors, right? And they've had less leeway to do that for wrong reasons over time, right? So, you know, one of the things that, that, I mean, if you look at where we were in the 1880s, right, when all these jury trials are disappearing, you also have a situation in which prosecutors and the lawyers that are trying the cases have a lot of leeway in terms of what jurors they pick. They have less now, but it's important to know to note that, you know, we started imposing those restrictions long after the death of the jury trial. So, for example, there's a case that every lawyer knows or should know called Batson versus Kentucky. And in that case, that was the first time that the Supreme Court ever said that a prosecutor or some other lawyer on a criminal case can't remove a juror just because of their race, right? So in other words, these prosecutors were striking black people using peremptory strikes just to take black people off juries. And the Supreme Court says you can't do that anymore. That opinion wasn't rendered until 1986, right? Long after the death of the jury trial for all intents and purposes in America, long after the beginning of the drug war, long after the beginning, you know, the onset of prohibition and all the things that drove the death of the jury trial and this sort of takeover of plea bargaining in the 20th century.
Can you expand on the prohibition point that you made there at how that increased criminalization for substances? Because that's also when we create the infrastructure for the war on drugs, which explodes, of course, Nixon and Reagan.
Sure. Yeah. So the federal government was not really involved in criminal prosecution all that much prior to prohibition, right? So when prohibition takes effect, prior to that time, crime is sort of thought of as a local problem. But then crime, in scare quotes, explodes overnight, right? And you have, you know, President Hoover and all these other figures coming out and saying, look, we've got to do something about this because now all of a sudden we've got all this crime and we got to go after the bootleggers and the people who are enabling the bootleggers and the people who enable the people who enable the bootleggers. And it's not just the bootleggers, folks. It's everybody. Everybody's doing crime everywhere. And so we've got to be able to stamp this out and we've got to be able to, you know, due process is nice, but we've got to be able to do it quickly. So what happens is the federal government gets involved in criminal prosecutions in a way that it never had before. The agency that eventually becomes the FBI, it explodes. They add thousands of new agents to that. The federal prison population triples during the period of prohibition from, I think by 1933, the population had tripled in just 13 years. And, you know, there's just all this capacity for the federal government to enforce these laws. And then Congress gets on board. It's like, okay, well, we've got all these toys, right? You know, the federal government has this capacity. Now, we should start making more crime for them to go after and make it easier for them to do their jobs and prosecute under. So they're passing crime bill after crime bill after crime bill, even when prohibition goes away. This is the important piece, right? When prohibition proves to be unsustainable, they take it away. But that next year, after the 21st Amendment passes, Congress passes 9 new federal crime bills, like these omnibus crime bills that will allow federal law enforcement, this new mechanism that they've created for the federal government to enforce the law. Now it has something to do, right? You know, since prohibition's gone ahead, it needs something to do. So they pass all these new crime bills. And President Roosevelt's attorney general gives this address where he's like, well, look, the number one thing, the number one threat to the fabric of American society is narcotics. It's not alcohol anymore. Now it's narcotics, right? And that's sort of the beginning seeds of the drug war that really took off, as you say, during the Nixon and Reagan eras.
And a lot of, I don't know if everyone realizes how in this time period, too, specific drugs were stereotypically linked to different racial groups. There's a reason that cannabis became marijuana. There's a reason that there were articles in Southern papers and also in Northern papers about, but I think particularly in the Louisiana area about black men who were able to stay up all night because of cocaine and rape your women, and then opium being associated with Asian American immigrants. And that was, I think, a way to launder that infrastructure from the Prohibition era as a way to target racial minority groups in this country. From even before the drug war, that was the infrastructure.
Yes, indeed. And think about plea bargaining's role in this. This is the thing I talk a lot about in the book. Because we've made a system that is really unconcerned with fact-finding, with truth-seeking, or any sort of processes, because we've made a system that is fundamentally concerned with speed above all else, we've also, that requires a lot of discretion, right? A lot of discretion by law enforcement, a lot of discretion by prosecutors, because if the police go out to arrest somebody, they're pretty sure, right, 9.7 times out of 10, that arrest is going to end in some kind of conviction, because the prosecutor has so much power, right? So they're going to use some kind of carrot, some kind of stick. They're going to keep them in jail for forever, or they're going to jack up the charges, or they're going to do whatever to get them to plead guilty to something. So police are less careful, and they know that they're never, in most cases, are never even going to have to present any kind of evidence or give any kind of testimony or be put under any kind of truthoscope, right? So if you have a cop that's a racist cop that just decides, I want to go out and arrest only black people, I'm never going to arrest white people ever. And that's what they go out and do. Well, it's very difficult to hold them accountable, because lo and behold, all those arrests end up in a conviction of some kind, right? And so the police officer, no matter how racist they are, they're vindicated in their actions. They're vindicated in their racism by the system, because it's just set up to result in a conviction of some kind, no matter what. And so great job. You did your job. You made an arrest, and that arrest ended in a conviction. Same goes for prosecutors. If prosecutors just decide, I'm going to prosecute all the black people on my docket more harshly, what stops them from doing that? Right. You know, so you jack up the charges. You can threaten them with anything. You could threaten them with, you know, extensive prison sentences at higher charges and compounded sentences and death. Even you could put the death penalty on the table for some defendants. And you're going to do that more harshly, as we've seen time and time again. Prosecutors do this more harshly for people of color. And what stops them from doing that? Nothing, because all of these prosecutions, virtually all of them, end in convictions of some kind.
In fact, I mean, the incentives actually go the other way, because the more convictions you get, the more successful your department is perceived as. The same thing with cops, right? There's financial incentives for them, arrests wise. So it's a beast that feeds one another, and it's your book and your analysis makes me realize that just criticism of cops and the policing in this country as an institution is insufficient when the other side of this is also the prosecution that feeds off of that very system.
Yeah. And what's really interesting is if you look at the example in Alaska that I talk a lot about in the book, or if you look at New Orleans, there's some other jurisdictions that have experimented with a reduction in plea bargaining in discrete periods of time. In Alaska, this is the clearest example. In Alaska, you've got an attorney general that comes in that has a lot of control because of the way state law is and says, well, we're just going to clamp down on plea bargaining. All the plea bargaining is going to go through me. We're going to do a whole lot less. We're going to have a whole lot more trials. And everyone's freaking out. This is in the 1970s. Everyone's freaking out because, oh, how are we going to do this? There's too much crime, and it's just going to crash the system, and there's no way we can handle all these trials, and there's just no way we can do this without plea bargaining virtually everything. And that turned out to be not true. And in fact, it had a very positive effect on the system overall. When you talk to, and I talked to a bunch of the lawyers that were around during that period of time, they said, yes, trials did go up. The number of trials did go up quite a bit, but also the number of charges went down. So what happens is prosecutors are forced, if they can't plead all these cases and just run a, you know, this sort of bureaucratic mill of conviction after conviction after conviction, if they have to look at the cases and assume that they're going to take them to trial, they get a whole lot more selective about what they prosecute. And in fact, in Alaska, what happened was prosecutors went from rejecting 4% of the cases that police brought to them to rejecting 44% overnight, you know, when this new policy was put in place. Of course, this makes police very mad, and it makes prosecutors and police do this for a time. You know, it makes them fight each other because, you know, these police are bringing them all these arrests. And, you know, unlike before where they could just bring them anything and walk away with a conviction almost for sure, prosecutors are saying, look, I'm not going to take that. You know, we're just going to dismiss this. This is a terrible case. You didn't cross your T's. You didn't dot your I's. I don't have good enough evidence here. But over time, even the police in Alaska say, well, this is actually better because it's forcing us to do better police work and bring in cases that we know we can get convictions on and, you know, to have charges that more accurately reflect the bad conduct that we arrested somebody for in the first place. So it had an enormous system-wide effect in Alaska for a short period of time. And then a new attorney general came in and changed everything back to the way it was.
So yeah, going back through our historical timeline a bit, I do just want to touch on the war on drugs era and maybe bring us to the present and how that affected the whole plea bargaining process.
Yeah, well, during the period of the war on drugs, it's kind of you have one of those things of the means sort of justifying the ends, I suppose. What I mean by that is whereas in the pre-drug war era, courts were not exactly sure if they wanted to have a criminal justice system that was based exclusively on, you know, haggling in the back rooms of courthouses. They weren't sure how much power they wanted to give to prosecutors to reach a plea agreement at whatever cost. And so you see a lot of disagreement within academia. You see a lot of, you know, conversation about this topic among lawyers on the ground. And there was a national commission on criminal defense that actually recommended that all plea bargaining be done away with by 1978. Obviously that didn't happen. The courts went the other direction. The courts were essentially issuing opinions, the Supreme Court especially, issuing opinions to accommodate the speed of the system, to make it easier for prosecutors to get convictions, to make it easier for defendants to plead, or harder to resist the plea bargain, I should say. And then finally, in the 1970s, you have this case called Bordenkercher versus Hayes. And what that case stands for, you have, and this is from right here in Kentucky, you've got a defendant who gets charged with writing a bad check. And the prosecutor comes to him and says, you're going to do 5 years. You've got a prior felony from 10 years ago. So you're going to do 5 years over this bad check. And Mr. Hayes says, I don't want to do 5 years over this bad check. That seems a lot of time to do for an $80 check, you know. And the prosecutor says, well, if you don't do 5 years, you don't take the 5-year deal and you, and this is his, these are his words, you make the court go through the inconvenience of a trial, then I'm going to hit you with this life sentence, right? And it's what we call the trial penalty now, right? For having the audacity to take a case to trial, you get hit with something even higher. So I'm going to hit you with these higher charges, these habitual offender charges, and you're going to do life. That's a mandatory life sentence. And Mr. Hayes says, thank you, but no thank you. I'll take my chances with the jury. The jury convicts him, and he gets a life sentence for an $80 check. And, you know, this is just the way we do things now, right? Jesus. You talk to lawyers that are within the criminal justice system that have been doing criminal practice for a while. They know this is the way we do things, and we take it for granted. But back then, it was controversial. This case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court says, well, it's the prosecutor's job to get a defendant to give up their right to trial, right? To relinquish their right to trial. To, you know, they, it's their job to bargain with them, and if the defendant doesn't want to make that deal, then that's fine. But you take your lumps, right? No matter what they are. So it's perfectly fine for you to get a life sentence for an $80 check. We don't see any problem with that. And that really throws open the floodgates. That's it. I mean, to my way of thinking, we don't teach that case that much in law schools. But to my way of thinking, that is a turning point in American history, because whatever resistance there was that courts had or prosecutors had to, you know, just no holds barred plea bargaining at that time went away after the Hayes case.
Well, it is a fundamentally imbalanced contract between somebody who's been arrested, has a criminal record hanging over their heads, and a prosecutor who has immense discretion and has the ability to put that person in prison. And it seems like the way that it's been treated, it's like it's a freedom of contract in between two parties, informally, really, within our own judicial system. But there's this retaliatory element that is completely accepted. Like, you made my job harder by exercising your constitutional rights. So here you go. This is what you deserve.
Yeah. Yeah. The courts that have tackled this have come to a place that I think is very silly over, you know, since the Hayes case. And, you know, that's within the last 50 years. They just say, well, this is a contract between the state and the defendant. And it's just like anything. It's like buying a used car, or like, you know, haggling over the price of a DVD at a flea market or something like that. Only we're talking about decades of someone's life.
Yeah.
And you talk about retaliatory measures. And I tell people, I've been doing this book tour, and I tell lay people that, you know, prosecutors can threaten a defendant with death if they exercise their right to a trial. Like, ha, 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 yeah, that's hyperbolic, canon. That's very funny. You don't mean to say that a prosecutor can actually threaten someone with death, like actual physical death. But that's exactly what happens. And lawyers, just criminal lawyers, just sort of take this for granted. If you don't take the deal that's on the table, the death penalty gets on the table. And that makes the stakes even higher, right? Because then you have to have a death-qualified jury, and it gets very messy. And the likelihood that your client's going to get popped at least with a life sentence, you know, let alone death, by a jury like that, goes up exponentially. And the statistics on this, there's a lot of chilling statistics in this book. But the statistics on this one really have stuck with me. 75% of all the people that have been put on death row since the 1970s, 75% of them could have avoided a death sentence by taking a plea offer, right? By pleading guilty. In other words, if they'd have taken the offer that the prosecutor put on the table, usually a life sentence offer, right? If in the cases of terrible murder. Prosecutor offers life. They say, no, I don't want life. I want to go to trial. Then the death penalty gets on the table, right? 75% of those cases are like that. And you think about the people that, you know, if you oppose the death penalty, which I do, you still want to think that, all right, you know, we have this terribly outdated thing that we do in the United States. We put people to death, but it's only reserved for the worst of the worst of the worst people that who commit the most heinous crimes. But if you think about the people who refuse to take the offer that a prosecutor gives them in a serious murder case, it's usually either, you know, the criminally insane, and there are people out there like that, of course, or people who are factually innocent, who really didn't do it, right? So I think if you look at those numbers, you look at those statistics, it suggests something very different than we're just putting the worst of the worst to death.
So I guess would be a good time to talk about the second part of your title, the creation of a permanent criminal class. What are some of the other jarring statistics about the result of this system, and what are some of the ramifications that I know some people might be familiar with, but taken in totality, this entire population that's gone through this system, what are the effects?
So I think maybe a good way to frame this is by looking at the difference between arrest rates. You know, if you look at the arrest rate in the United States versus other common law countries, other countries that have legal systems similar to ours, Canada, the UK, Australia. Yeah, you know, look at the arrest rate in the UK. It's 1,400 people, roughly 1,400 people per every 100,000 get arrested every year. Right? In Canada, it's 600. Right? 600 people for every 100,000. For us, it's 3,000, more than twice what it is in Britain. Right? And so you look at those kind of statistics and you think, well, what's going on here? Is there something, I think, you know, you come to one of two conclusions. Either there's something special about Americans that makes us, you know, uniquely predisposed to criminal behavior. It's too much sex on TV. It's violent video games. It's high fructose corn syrup, whatever it is. Right. Or you can accept that there's a mechanism that is making more criminals faster in the U.S. And my argument is that that mechanism chiefly is the plea bargain. There's a few of them, but the plea bargain.
Or it's just a people's pathology here in the United States. We're just we're just full of criminals and we all suck, right? Apparently.
Yeah, yeah. We're just so cool. We're fundamentally different as human beings from people in Canada and the UK. And that's just how they are. We're just more likely to be criminals.
It's all the freedom in the water.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's when you look at those kind of statistics and then you think about the original purposes for the institution of plea bargaining, the relaxation of restrictions on plea bargaining back in the 1830s, which, as I've argued, is to undermine the labor movement. Well, what does slapping a criminal label on that many people do? Right now, one-third, almost a complete one-third of all adults in the United States have some kind of arrest or conviction record, right? It's huge. It's a massive number of people. And it's, you know, every human civilization in the world has had a criminal class of some kind, right? We all know what that means for it to have, you know, this sort of separate box that we put our criminals into. And these are the people that you stay away from. And these are the people that you don't let your kids hang around. And these are the people that you don't open a business with and that sort of thing, right? So we've retained that ancient stigma in the United States. We still know what it means to be part of the criminal class. But what we've done is we've just swept an enormous number of people into that. More, we've expanded and amplified the boundaries of that criminal class to more people than any other civilization in the history of the world, right? And we don't really care what somebody was convicted of. We just know that they're part of the criminal class. You look at the psychological studies that have been done on people that have had the criminal label slapped on them. And it's profound. You know, the difference between somebody who has been accused of a crime and somebody has been convicted of a crime is huge, both in the way that they interact with other, that society interacts with them and the way that they interact with society, right? So somebody who's been convicted of something, somebody who's been labeled a criminal and swept into that criminal class is more likely to engage in further criminal behaviors. They're less likely to participate in civic activities of any kind. They're more likely to take on all sorts of antisocial behaviors. So we don't want to play with them anymore and they don't want to play, period. Right. And what has that done to, when you apply that to a full third of the population, what has that done to working class solidarity in this country over the last 200 years? Well, I mean, compare our labor movement to every other labor movement in the world. It would be silly to say that plea bargaining is the cause for the difference in, you know, the sort of social welfare safety net that the working class has been able to get for itself here in the United States and versus every other country in the world. But I don't think it's far-fetched to say that it's a cause. You know, it's a factor in that.
Well, it's something I learned from you is that it is in its origins that was what it was designed to do. Yes. The fact that this mass acceptance of plea deals was born out of an attempt to break working class solidarity in the midst of the Industrial Revolution in New England is, I think, very instructive for people trying to understand the churn of our criminal justice system today. And yeah. it, of course, it has different flavors or manifestations, like in the way that the drug laws are explicitly racist, but it is fundamentally designed to create to other the working class so that there isn't solidarity.
Absolutely. And it's hard for people to accept that, right? You know, it's hard for casual observers of the criminal justice system. It's hard for law students. It's hard for lawyers to accept it, right? Because you think, if you look at the system up close and you're part of it and you see good people in it, and I think most of the people that work within the system are good people. Most, even the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, even some of the police, right, are good people. And you know, the point that I try to make in the book is you can put good people into a fundamentally bad system and still have bad outcomes, right? We want to look at the criminal justice system and say, well, look, there's a few bad apples in it, but this is still a pretty good system and it does what it's designed to do. And so we have some aberrations and we have some bad things that happen. And what I'm saying is the bad things are the norm. When good things happen out of the criminal justice system, that is the aberration. Because it's not, that is the system not working to preserve boundaries, class boundaries and race boundaries and that sort of thing, right? And if you look at the mechanisms that we've carried forward from when the courts were explicitly classist, I mean, I don't think that you can look at the Victorian period and say, the courts weren't classist. Of course they were, and most people accept that. But I think the real question to ask is, when did that change? Like, when did we fundamentally just turn on our heels and say, we're going to have a new system now? That never happened. We pride ourselves on the sameness of the system, in fact. And so you get these mechanisms that are carried forward, like cash bail, like, hiring private attorneys if you want to choose who your attorney is, like the plea bargain, those mechanisms that were designed explicitly to stake boundaries between classes or races have been carried forward, and we still do them, right? We just don't think that since the people that are involved in it have no ill motive, then there's no problem with that.
It reminds me of kind of some conversations that people will have about how under J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI was racist and targeting black civil rights groups. It's like, yeah, it didn't change that much to this day, and there's way more continuity than there is shift. And recognition of something historically does not mean that the institutions change whatsoever. Like, I find it frustrating sometimes when we're talking about really changing things systemically that people see a historical understanding as a substitute for an actual overhaul of a system.
Yes. No, I agree with that 100%. And I get the question often, well, how do we fix this? What is the way that we fix it? And I propose some fixes in the book. And I think there are ways that you can make, that people can make grassroots change to the criminal justice system. But, when you look at the thing in its ugly eye, it's really hard for me to imagine reform of this system as opposed to a rebuild, right? It's hard for me to imagine reform of this system that would work and make it something, that results in what a sane person would call anything like justice.
Last question. I know I've kept you a bit over, if you don't mind. Do you mind just saying a bit about some of those possible reforms and then I'll let you go?
Well, sure. In terms of what people can do on the ground, what I've done in the last part of the book is to interview criminal justice organizers, really excellent criminal justice organizers that have been able to build coalitions on the ground to change public opinion about discrete issues of criminal justice, right? And so what I've tried to do is to take their successes and make them into a blueprint for future successes. Is that what works and what was your messaging strategy and how did you go about doing it? And so I've boiled it down to a few principles that people could use. And if a movement wanted to use this to restrict plea bargaining in a discrete area, as I've said before, I think that could have a profound system-wide effect. If you increase the number of trials in an area just by 10 to 20%. We're at 97%, right? So if you go up to 90%, right, or 85%, you've doubled or tripled the amount of resources that it takes to administer criminal justice. And it forces the system, you know, the sort of prevailing wisdom as long as I've been an attorney is, well, that's going to crash the system and it's going to cause criminal justice to come to a screeching halt. But what history shows is that that's not what happens. The system adapts and the system becomes smarter, and it forces prosecutors to develop priorities that are more in line, I think, with community norms and mores.
Dan Cannon, a civil rights lawyer, law professor at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, and you could get his book everywhere where books are sold, Pleading Out, How Plea Bargaining Creates a Permanent Criminal Class. We will put the links to your book, Dan, in the podcast description, YouTube description, others as well. I really can't thank you enough for this discussion. I really, really enjoyed it very much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Back.
All right, we're back. We have a connection. David, can you hear me?
Sam, yeah, I can hear you. Hi.
Okay, you're calling from plus 44 number. That, if I'm not mistaken, that is, are you out of the country?
Can you lower your voice a little? I'm in a hotel room, and so I need you to, my mother is still sleeping, and I need you to whisper, so if you could just keep it down.
Okay. All right. I will keep it. But wait, where are you? Well, I can't whisper. What?
My mother, every summer she takes my sister and me to Europe, and we stay in the same hotel room, and my mom's tired. She's been watching, you know, the funeral stuff, so she's exhausted from watching it. So, so can you keep it down?
Yeah, I can keep it down. But David, wait. First off, wait. How old is your mother?
I don't want to. She would kill me if I talked about that. But she's my sister and I. My older sister and I and my mom were traveling, you know, through Europe. My mom's very generous, and we're staying in the same hotel room.
That seems odd. Like, how big is the hotel room?
And she takes the cot. My mom takes the cot.
Okay.
But
right.
My sister and I get the queen bed. But you got to keep it down. So, yeah, I'm in. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in London. I'm in London.
Okay. You're in London. All right.
Yeah.
And,
Not good. You know, my mom was looking forward, to seeing the changing of the guard and, you know, seeing London, you know, it's a mob now. The queen died. Did you hear that the queen died?
Yeah, I did.
Heard that.
Yeah. I did hear the queen died. Of course I heard the queen died. It was, you almost can't avoid that. Is your mom?
It's a mob. My mother is barely ambulatory, and the queen, so like we can't see anything. The traffic is horrible. You know, I complained a little, but I don't want to be, you know, so we're stuck in, you know, we've been watching the TV, so it's, you know.
Okay. Well, I mean, nice. The funeral, my understanding is next week. Like, so the mood has been, I mean, what is the mood like there?
Well, I've been, you know, talking to people here. I have to whisper.
I know. You keep saying that.
Yeah. The mood is, you know, it's, somber, you know, here in London, you know, I'm in England, by the way. It's London, England.
Yeah, I know. No kidding.
We got that, yeah.
Where else would the...
Oh, is that Emma?
Yeah, hi.
Oh, hi. I can't... Yeah, it's you know, because there's London, Ontario, too, you know, which is in Canada.
Right. Yeah. Be odd for your mom to take you and your sister and stay in the same hotel room in London, Ontario.
No, London, England.
I know that, but I think, well, frankly, it's odd that your mom's doing that anyways with your both.
Why? She's very generous.
I understand. Maybe she could spring for a separate hotel. You got, like, she's, well, it's all right. I'm not judging. It's just odd that, you're like.
She takes the cot. She's sleeping on the cot. My sister and I have the queen bed. My mother, we're the three musketeers.
Right.
What?
Okay.
Why waste?
No, no, I got you. That's great.
I don't know why. So, you know, there. Anyway, so it's London, England.
Right.
Not London, Ontario. There are two Londons.
Right? Well, there's probably more. There's New London and Connecticut.
Michael London, who played Little Joe on Bonanza.
That was Landon, I think.
Michael London, he played Landon. Little Joe on Little House on
Landon.
The Prairie.
Landon. Michael Landon.
Michael London, he played Landon. Little Joe on...
It doesn't matter.
Little Joe
no
on
one
Little Highway
watches
to Heaven.
The show.
You ever watched Little Highway to Heaven?
Watched any of that. That was David Hasselhoff, I think. Like, look, it doesn't matter.
It was Michael London. Michael London.
Okay. It doesn't matter because nobody knows.
You know what, Emma?
Yeah.
Can you look it up? I'm pretty sure it's Michael London.
Look, you're
not Michael Landon.
Can you have
Wikipedia?
Yeah, I have it.
David. It doesn't.
Hang on. What?
It's Michael Landon. It's Michael Landon.
Michael Landon. It's Michael Landon.
It's Michael Landon.
Okay. All right. No need to. Thank you. See, I have a little jet lag.
No, I'm sorry for raising my voice.
I'm here in Landon, England, and the funeral is next week. So.
Yeah, that's what I just said. The funeral's next week. And so, how is it over there? Are people? I mean,
well, you know, I haven't been outside. My mother is barely ambulatory, and so we talk to the people who clean up. You know, it's hard for Americans to understand what Queen Elizabeth meant to the British people. Are you familiar with The Crown? You know, Netflix.
Yeah,
The Crown.
I am. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's not really my cup of tea.
No, it's a television show, you moron.
No, I know it's a television show. It's on Netflix. What are you getting? It's a little bit hostile.
You just said you just called it a cup of tea. It's a television show. It's not a cup of tea.
That's a saying. No,
Christ, I can't believe this. I didn't want to do. If you were here in Landon, seeing what this nation is going through, maybe you wouldn't be so flippant, Sam.
Yeah.
Comparing the Queen of England to a cup of tea. I don't know. It's why ugly. You're an ugly American.
Compare the Queen to a cup of tea. I don't even know what that would be.
Emma, does he listen? Does he listen to himself?
I mean, David,
I don't want to triangulate here, but
I don't think that he compared the Queen to a cup of tea.
Okay, the two of you are gaslighting me. Play it back. I just said, do you watch The Crown? And Sam said something along the lines of, and I didn't write it down, but he said something about wanting to teabag the Queen.
No, I did not.
Oh my God.
I did not.
I'm on vacation. I'm with my mother. And you say, oh, you're in London. Come on the show. I didn't write that. You said something. Play it back. I said, do you watch The Crown? And you said something about the Windsor bosom and wanting to teabag the Queen.
Windsor bosom? I don't even know. What are you talking about? I don't even know what the Windsor bosom is.
Okay. You're gaslighting. This is like, I don't need this right now. I'm not gaslighting you at all.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
You're gaslighting me. You're playing dumb.
I'm not playing dumb.
You're what?
I am not playing dumb.
Yeah, you don't need to play dumb. Just be your. That's how I would direct you. Just be yourself.
That's great.
I would cast you
all right,
in a pilot. I would say, Sam, just be yourself. Don't David, play dumb. Just be yourself. Because you know what? Not to be. I don't want to wake my mother.
David, I get it. All right,
you're dumb.
You're with your parents. I've been there. You suddenly it makes you a little tense. You're on vacation, but I don't know why you're getting you're incredibly hostile. I'm asking you about the funeral. You're in London, and now you're talking about the Windsor bosom. I don't even know what that is.
The Windsor bosom. It's the Windsor bosom. Everybody knows about the That's why she wears a crown. You idiot. So
what?
The eyes are drawn upwards away from the Windsor bosom. You're not allowed to see the Windsor bosom. It's like, I don't know, the Ark of the Covenant from Indiana Jones. You know, if you stare too long, your face contorts, your eyes bulge, your ears flip upwards. It's why Prince Charles looks the way he does. She breastfed him.
What?
A Windsor bosom.
There's no such thing as a Windsor bosom, David. Come on.
The Windsor bosom.
You're saying that the Queen's breasts are referred to as the Windsor bosom, and it's like the Ark of the Covenant, and that Prince Charles had that look on his face because as a child he was breastfed from the Windsor bosom.
He was breastfed. Yes, it's like the Ark. I just said that you can't, if you're in the presence of Her Majesty. This is why it's a closed coffin. Nobody's allowed to see the Windsor bosom. If your eyes accidentally, bear witness to her, I want to put this, her heaving décolletage. Am I being too spicy here? Calling it a,
I don't know what you're being, to be honest with you.
If the reason it's a closed coffin and it's draped is because you cannot bear witness to her heaving, pulsating décolletage with those ripples of girl power. You can't take your eyes off of it. It's like a car crash. It's just,
What? You're saying the Windsor bosom is like a car crash?
Yes. You can't take your eyes off it. You shouldn't look, but you do, and you can't unsee it.
Hey, David, I don't know what's going on, if it's like this has to do with you traveling with your mom, with all due respect, but there's no such thing as the Windsor bosom. That doesn't
the Windsor never, bosom.
People can Google it. It doesn't exist.
Google the Windsor bosom.
Yeah, and I can assure you it's not compared to a car crash.
It's compared to a car crash. It's exact. The Windsor bosom. Go read Princess Di's death certificate. Can you look it up, Emma? Go look up Princess Di's death certificate. Under cause of death.
Yes.
Under cause of death, it says Windsor bosom.
No, like, no. What? She died in a car crash, David.
But the queen was not there. By the Windsor bosom. What are you talking, David? I think, maybe we need to do this another time. maybe you're not feeling well.
I feel fine. I just don't know why you're. I don't know. I don't know why the two of you.
You're making stuff up, David, and you're acting odd.
Yeah, you're acting odd. You're the weirdo, not me.
I'm not.
You're
sure.
Weird.
Okay.
I'm telling you the truth. I'm telling you the truth. Princess Di, by the way, is dead. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I didn't want to ruin the new season of The Crown for you, but she dies. So.
All right. Great.
I didn't want to ruin your cup of tea. But Princess Di is dead.
Yeah. All right. Princess Di is dead. There you go.
Yeah. That's... Princess. You know what's weird about Princess? Do you mind if I just jotted something down here. You know what's weird is that her last name was Di, and she died. But that word, that's kind of...
I mean...
That's funny. I was thinking of doing it in my act. Like, hey.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is the Princess Di is not her... That Di is not her last name.
It was her maiden name.
No. Her name is Diane. That's her first name.
No.
Princess Diane.
No. You're
Diana, I guess.
Diana.
It really was.
No. She married Charles. It became Windsor, but then after the divorce, she went back to being Princess Di. Anyway.
No.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. She's dead.
Yes. No, I think everybody knows.
I don't want to ruin. What?
Everybody knows she's dead. She did not die.
I didn't want to ruin your cup of tea. I know you're looking forward to watching Netflix.
I'm not.
And I want to ruin your cup of tea.
But I can assure you, even on the show, the cause of her death was not officially listed as the Windsor bosom. None of that exists.
You want to stay a child? You know what? You're a child, and you want to stay a child and not believe the queen had Princess Di killed. You go right ahead, Sam. Just Peter Pan, your life. Just never grow up, Peter Pan. I'm going to start calling you Peter Pan.
I was actually a grown person when she died, and it was not from the Windsor bosom. None of what you're talking about is true. Let's just talk about the funeral. I saw a report that said, that was in the Jacobin, that said that people are being arrested just for criticizing the monarchy. Let's talk about that or something.
About attacking the
whatever.
Monarchy.
Let's talk about the funeral. Let's not talk about the queen's
wait, hang on. You know, to disrespect the royal family, what is 150,000 Mau Maus rounded up and placed in a concentration camp, raped and castrated. I mean, we're going to hold that? You're going to hold England accountable for dividing India into Muslims and Hindu and creating Pakistan and Kashmir, genocide and and dipping bullets in pork before they shoot at Muslims? I mean, you're going to hold England accountable for what happened in Africa? I mean, go ahead, Barbados, Bermuda. I mean, you're like my third wife. Just coiled like a snake in the grass, waiting for me to make a mistake and then jumping on me.
I mean, everything you outlined is the almost the only true things that you've been talking about.
Yeah, well, so what are you going to do? You're going to just sit back, you know, piss into the tent instead of be in the tent and rubbing it all over your body? I'd rather be in the tent rubbing it all over my body than be outside the tent pissing into it.
I got to be totally honest with you. I have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, I know the metaphor, pissing into the tent, pissing out of the tent, but rubbing your urine all over you, you've lost me a little bit. I'm just asking you about the funeral, okay? That's all. You're being an idiot. You're being very odd. Are you drunk?
Hello?
David? Did he hang up on me?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, you're waking my mother.
No, I'm not waking your mother. I don't know why you didn't step out to do this or do this when your mom wasn't taking a nap. I don't know why you're with your mom. I don't know what you're talking about.
Because I
asked you to talk about the funeral, and then you're going off about urinating on
because of the COVID. You want me to give my mother COVID? I'm not leaving the hotel room.
Why did you go there in the first place? You would have been better off going to London, Ontario.
We're in London, England. Okay, that's where my mother is very generous. She just died, and my sister and I took her. You know, collecting the social security checks, and we have to be in another country, so the social security checks keep coming. And she's very generous and having a fantastic time, and you're ruining it for me.
Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I want to know about the funeral. If you have nothing to talk about,
no offense. I think you and Emma. And don't take this the wrong way. I think you get your news from the corporate controlled media, and you need to broaden your horizons. And did you listen to Tulsi Gabbard on the Jimmy Dore show live from Comic-Con last week? See, if you listen to Jimmy Dore live from Comic-Con with Tulsi Gabbard, you would know these things. But
I do not listen to Tulsi Gabbard. I did not realize that they were at Comic-Con.
So. She's a combat veteran, right? But you don't listen to her because she's a combat. Why do you hate our troops? Why do you hate the troops, Sam?
I mean, there's reasons, but I don't particularly hate the troops. I don't
You think Tulsi. They're stupid. You think they're stupid. You think Tulsi Gabbard is stupid.
I don't know if she's stupid, but what she said.
You think the troops are stupid.
I don't think the troops are stupid. I don't think
the troops are stupid.
I do not think the troops are stupid.
You just said, play it back. You just said Tulsi Gabbard is stupid because she served in the military.
I did not say that.
You just said that.
I never said that.
Go back and listen.
Nope.
Play it back. You just said it. You just said 9/11 was the best thing ever to happen to America because we had it coming. Just said that.
Did not say that.
I just heard. Don't gaslight me. You just said 9/11 was the best thing ever to happen to America because we had it coming. Emma, didn't he just say that?
No, David, he did not just say that.
Okay,
he did not.
You're
gaslighting us.
The two of you. I get it. Okay. I get it. I get it. Okay.
Well,
You're just hearing things. I don't know what, I don't understand what you're doing.
You know what, Emma?
Yeah.
You are jealous of Jimmy Dore, and Sam is jealous of his protege, Jackson Hinkle, and the two of you are seething. You can't handle it because Tucker Carlson had Jackson Hinkle on his show, and the two of you are going, well, why didn't Why didn't Tucker ask us to be?
I know why Tucker didn't add it, but yes, we actually saw Jackson Hinkle on Tucker Carlson. That is, it was.
Right. And it's eating you up alive because he's doing what you do, and Tucker Carlson would rather have Jackson Hinkle than the two of you. And I love Jackson Hinkle. He's a Marxist who gives stock tips, and, you know, he's. You're jealous, man.
I'm not jealous.
You're jealous of Jackson Hinkle.
I would not take stock tips from him. No, I would not do that either.
Because you know, he's only 21.
I have no idea how old he is. I wouldn't be surprised.
I thought he was 22. If you listen to him, you think that's a 22-year-old. No, Jackson Hinkle is only 21. He's so young, but so wise. So wise. And it eats you up. He says things. He has insight that you don't. Did you know that he's a socialist who hates George Soros? Did you know that?
He's a what?
He's a socialist who hates George Soros.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he calls himself a socialist. Doesn't he also sell gold?
He's brilliant. He's a communist socialist who hates George Soros.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was watching him on Tucker Carlson. See, I can handle other people's success, unlike you.
Right.
I can watch someone thriving and say, you go ahead, make room for the younger people. And he was saying that George Soros is hypnotizing the world. Mm. I didn't know that.
Mm.
And he's against helping that comedian, Zelensky, in Ukraine. He said, Soros, this is really wise.
Hmm.
He said to Tucker Carlson, he says, why are we giving money to Ukraine when we need it back here in America?
Yeah, wow. I know.
I went, wow, Jackson, for a 21-year-old, wow.
I know who Hinkle is.
Jackson Hinkle.
I had him on the show. We sort of debated the fact that he doesn't like the fact that I'm.
Why would you debate Jackson Hinkle? Well, he's on our side. He's a socialist.
Well, he really wanted to, and I don't think
he's a socialist.
He's really on our side. I don't know what that really means, but I don't think so.
Okay. You know that I'm a lefty from way back, right?
Yes, we know, actually, yeah. I do know okay. that, yeah.
Okay, and I can spot a lefty from the future, and that Jackson Hinkle, I'm telling you, he is a socialist. And he wants to focus on America, not Ukraine. Go watch him on My Mother's Stirring. Hang on for once. I'll keep it down. He's a socialist who wants to focus on America, not Ukraine. And,
right.
and he says America first. Right. Have you ever heard that before?
I have heard that before, yeah. America first.
Yeah. Not Ukraine.
Right.
Right? Nothing wrong with a little nationalism, Sam. Okay, I understand nationalism is a freighted term, but there's nothing wrong with a little patriotism, right? Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with being a national socialist, Sam, like Mr. Hinkle.
Right, national, where have I heard that before?
From Jackson Hinkle with Tucker Carlson. Why should the right wing own patriotism, right? Why can't we be nationalists? Why can't we be national socialists?
I mean, I think a lot of people argue
who support unions.
Socialism is supposed to be international in many respects, is one of the things. But
supports unions. He supports, you know, he says he loves the German model where 40% of every German corporation has union representation sitting on the board of directors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth Warren has talked about
that. Yeah, that's true.
What's wrong with loving this country, supporting German workers, right? Modeling loving our country, loving. So he's a national socialist, German workers kind of guy. Mm. And we should let him. I don't know. We should support this guy. I know he ran for office, and I think it was in San Clemente, right?
I think so. Local office, maybe. I'm not quite sure.
Well, I hope the guy is young, and I hope he starts, like a National Socialist German Workers Party that we can get on board. I mean, he's a socialist, you know?
Right, 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 right. Yeah. You would be very excited for that. I don't know. I don't.
And he hates George. And he hates George Soros.
Right.
That's like the added benefit is he hates George Soros and that Zelensky guy. And until he started crapping on Zelensky and George Soros, I began to realize, hey, they look alike.
Hmm.
Right? Have you ever, like, they sound alike? Did you ever notice that George Soros and that Zelensky guy kind of, you know, they have something in common. I don't know what it is, but I hate them both.
Yeah, well, they do have something in common. I mean, they're both Jewish.
I hate them.
But they don't look like each other. I think, like, they're 50 years apart in age.
They're like father and son. They look alike.
They don't.
Sound alike.
No, they're just, they're both Jewish. That's it.
Who's Jewish?
Well, Soros is Jewish and Zelensky's Jewish. They're both Jewish. Jackson Hinkle railed on Tucker Carlson. They're both Jewish, and he claimed that there was some type of, like, you know, international cabal.
Wait.
That is, orchestrated.
George Soros? Wait. Because I don't pay attention to this thing the way you do. You're saying George Soros is Jewish?
Yeah.
With a rat face? He's a Jew?
I'm sorry.
I don't...
With a what?
Interesting. He has a kind of rat face on him. What about Zelensky?
Zelensky is also Jewish, but I don't know about, like, what you're
saying. The short guy running around trying to start a war?
Well, he didn't really try and start a war. I mean, the country was invaded by Russia.
No, you're saying the guy who tricked Putin into invading Ukraine the way Mika Zabrinsky's father tricked the Russians into invading Afghanistan to create a quagmire so the
quagmire?
Empire would... Yeah, you're saying that this rat face Zelensky hypnotized the world and Putin and tricked him into invading Ukraine?
And
you're saying...
No.
Because Jackson Hinkle, I listened to Jackson. He never mentioned that Zelensky is Jewish. And I just know from Jackson Hinkle that George Soros hypnotized the world and profits off wars and starts all wars and is in bed with the military-industrial complex. But I didn't know that they were Jewish.
Well, I mean, they're Jewish. They're Jewish. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay. I don't pay attention to those kind of things. I just listen to Jackson Hinkle. Is Jackson Hinkle Jewish?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
He sells gold on the show.
David.
Are you sure he's not Jewish?
David, he's not Jewish. I don't know what you're suggesting. He sells gold on his show. I mean, that's a, I don't know if you are aware of this, but there's been a lot more anti-Semitism as of late in the past several years, but everything you're trafficking in is a little bit anti-Semitic tropes, like, you know, George Soros is
I don't pay attention to that kind of stuff.
Well, you should know. I mean, I don't know how you got by your however old you are without being aware that, you know, Soros is often used as a sort of a surrogate for, you know, Jewish critique. I mean, you could critique the guy.
I don't care that he's
But the idea that George Soros is, like, creating all wars and is a puppet master,
that
Zelensky is tied into it.
That I object to.
Jews sell gold. That's not, I don't know where you're picking all this stuff up from.
No, I have no problem with, I agree with you that George Soros controls the world economy with the Rothschilds and creates all wars, and that Zelensky, who's got offshore accounts, I think it was the Panama Papers, he's been in cahoots with George Soros. They both share a grandfather who was, I think, Adolf Hitler's uncle. I think both Soros and Zelensky are descendants of Adolf Hitler's Jewish uncle. But I don't pay attention to your, you know, people's religion. I just, like Jackson. I'm watching Jackson Hinkle, and I don't hate George Soros and Zelensky. If you say they're Jewish, I don't. But you know, these rat faced, money hungry, war mongering vermin that Jackson Hinkle speaks about. I hate them because they're vermin, and they're going to breed with our children. And I just think that's what I don't hate them because they're. I don't even
George Soros, I don't know who's is going to breed with your kids. I'm sorry.
I'm worried George Soros is going to fornicate daughter.
I'm quite sure that's not going to happen. I would also probably be willing Zelensky, to bet that Zelensky's never Zelensky, gonna be anyone in your family. I would Zelensky, say like, none of that is going to happen.
Who control? You know, he controls the media. Zelensky in Ukraine, and I mean, you know, right. I'm just worried. Ukraine. Anyway,
it's there. There's a war going on there. Listen, I don't know that.
Are you sure, Jackson? Hang on for 1 second. Are you sure Jackson Hinkle, who I watch every night, and I'm a subscriber? Are you sure he's not Jewish? Can you put a picture? Can we look at a picture of? Do you have one? Because I'm telling you, I don't pay attention to these things. I minored in phrenology at community college. I had a minor in phrenology, skull shapes, bumps on the head.
Okay.
But are you sure Jackson Hinkle?
I'm not sure, but I don't believe he is Jewish.
Are you sure? Because I met him once, and I tricked him into a scalp massage, and I felt the bumps on his head, and I went, Jew.
Wait, are you saying like there's horns that Jews have horns bumps on their heads?
It's phrenology, you child. Forget it, Peter Pan. Don't grow up. But I gave Jackson Hinkle a scalp massage, and while he was relaxed, I read the bumps on Jackson Hinkle's skull. And again, it's been a couple of years since I studied phrenology at Bergen Community College, but my fingertips read Jew. Are you sure he's not a Jew?
He's not a Jew. He's not a Jew. And
do you have a picture of him?
I don't know. Do we have a? Can we get a picture of him?
Are you absolutely positive? What Jackson?
Yeah, that's not.
He's Jewish.
No,
he's a Jew. He'll do anything for money. He's a Jew. Jackson Hinkle will say and do anything for money. He is a Jew. And the bumps, I have the bumps on his head to prove it, that Jackson Hinkle is a Jew. So how could he be anti-Semitic?
I think we probably got to wrap this up because I don't want to wake up your mom. That's what it's like. Your mom's probably stirring by now, right? So, David, this has been really edifying. And industry.
All right. Are you a Jew, Sam?
Yes, I am a Jew, David. My last name is Cedar. It's like literally the Seder.
It's wood.
Right? Well, it's wood. S-E-D-E-R.
Cedar wood.
No.
What?
No. Seder. It's spelled like Seder. It's a Jew. You're Jewish. I don't know.
I didn't know you were Jewish. I don't pay attention to those kind of things. But you do seem kind of rich and controlling. Maybe that's why Jackson Hinkle doesn't like you.
David, it has been a real interesting conversation. I want to say goodbye to you now. And best of luck in London, the hotel room.
Thank you.
All right.
Heil Hinkle. Heil Hinkle.
I'm sorry. Excuse me? What did you say?
Nothing. I just said Jews will not replace us.
Oh, all right. That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Heil Hinkle.
All right,
Heil
David. Hinkle. I appreciate the call. That was
something.
I don't know what's going on with David right now.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. worst dismay. For the option where you don't get paid. For the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost but dry. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out of.